Chapter 6. Ansel Keys and the Dark Side of the American Heart Association. In this chapter, you will learn the American Heart Association started promoting vegetable oil after receiving money from the vegetable oil industry in 1948. Much of this money was used to support one man's attempts to link heart attacks to high cholesterol. To make the cholesterol theory look better, this man suppressed data showing that smoking caused heart attacks. The AHA now publishes 14 journals that continue to miseducate doctors about the cause of heart disease. Back when I first started learning about vegetable oil, I realized I should probably learn more about the history of nutrition science. During my college, medical school, and specialty education years, I learned about all kinds of important figures in medical history and details of their discoveries. I learned about the barber surgeons of the Middle Ages who provided grooming services, dental extractions, minor surgeries, and sometimes amputations. I'd learned about the history of anesthesia, starting with whiskey, progressing to chloroform, and then to the safer drugs we use today. So it struck me as odd that I'd never been presented with the "How did we get here?" history of nutrition science. The one thing I'd learned was that a man named Ansel Keys had linked cholesterol to heart attacks in the 1950s and 1960s with his diet-heart hypothesis. A closer look at Dr. Keys and his work provides that "How did we get here?" story of nutrition science, and what it says about our current nutrition paradigm is troubling. The flawed father of the diet-heart hypothesis. Ansel Keys is a controversial figure in science. On one hand, Dr. Keys is celebrated as the man who discovered the cause of heart attacks, and every medical student learns his name. On the other hand, his methods have been considered substandard since the beginning, although doctors are generally unaware of this aspect of medical history. The controversy around Dr. Keys' methods begins with the first paper he wrote in support of his diet-heart hypothesis in 1953, called Atherosclerosis, a Problem in Newer Public Health. Doctors had recognized coronary artery disease since the Middle Ages, but it was exceedingly rare. As recently as the 1910s, cardiologists could go their entire careers without ever seeing a heart attack. In his paper, Dr. Keys provides his viewpoint that dietary fat consumption drives heart disease by elevating cholesterol in the bloodstream. It was a bold declaration, but men were being struck down in their 40s and 50s by deadly heart attacks, and the country was absolutely gripped with fear over this new epidemic. If Dr. Keys had been right, it would have made him a true hero for warning the world at a time when most doctors had almost no experience with the condition. Other investigators were still examining other causes, including smoking, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, aka diabetes, and stress. But Dr. Keys had honed in on cholesterol and seemed blind to the existence of other factors. Dr. Keys' 1953 paper boldly asserts that it is a fact that people with heart disease tend to have blood serum characterized by high cholesterol. But the evidence he offers in support of this fact is flimsy at best. 15 of the 16 tables and figures he provides to back up a link between cholesterol and heart disease only provide irrelevant information, including cholesterol values for healthy men in several major cities, changes in cholesterol levels after eating nothing but rice and fruit for 3 weeks, changes in cholesterol levels in response to dietary cholesterol in rabbits, chickens, and a few other species, none of which could be used to support his point. Only one data set shows any kind of correlation between diet and heart disease at all. Still, it says nothing about cholesterol. This figure is a simple graph with 6 data points sitting along a line. The graph plotted how much fat people ate in a given country versus the per capita rate of heart attacks in that country. According to the graph, people in Japan ate the least fat of all the six countries he discussed, and also had the fewest heart attacks per capita. People in the United States ate the most fat and sat at the top of the line, outnumbering the per capita heart attack deaths by 15-1. The four countries in between sat neatly on the line, linking the two extremes. Although the data was skimpy, at least the dietary fat heart disease correlation looked solid. The trouble was, he cheated. Dr. Keyes had left out the 16 other countries that didn't fit along the neat line. This fact was made public by the authors of a 1957 paper that presented a similar graph with all 22 countries, showing points scattered all over the place, with no indication of any such neat perfect line. They concluded by specifically calling out Dr. Keyes's blunder, writing, "It is immediately obvious that the inclusion of all the countries greatly reduces the apparent association." Dr. Keyes's written responses to the critics who called out this deception have been described as sarcastic, where professionalism was called for. Rather than welcoming dialogue around alternative viewpoints, which is generally considered a necessary part of the scientific process, he did not like challenge from friends or foes. Even his friends described him as a bully. His critics called him arrogant, blunt, and dismissive, and were suspicious of the fact that he never encouraged active debate. His fraudulent paper has come to be known as the Six Countries Study, even though that's not its actual title, because this story is so often told. What's less well known about Dr. Keyes is that this wasn't the only time he pulled a trick like that. His most famous and influential work was called the Seven Countries Study. This study began in the 1950s and continued for several decades, eventually leading to hundreds of publications. But when you read the study's reports, published periodically between 1970 and 1993, you find lots of unimportant information on irrelevant topics. Things like what railroad company employees in Europe did differently from people living in Japan, and musings on the day-to-day activities of people collecting the data in Eastern versus Western Finland. The reports do not adhere to any standard of data collection or presentation. There appears to have been no standardized method of determining what people were eating. There are no figures summarizing the big picture that would support the conclusion that saturated fat led to elevated cholesterol, and that cholesterol was causing heart attacks. There isn't even a simple summary of how many people participated in the nutrition surveys, and there is no single chart that details the total number of heart attacks. This is basic data, and it's entirely missing. Yet the Seven Countries Study has become a cornerstone of medicine. It is still cited today as the proof that high cholesterol causes heart attacks. Others have reviewed the data from the Seven Countries Study and found it to be full of holes. In 2014, a journalist who had spent 10 years researching the history of our current dietary guidelines dug up some disturbing information. When interviewing doctors and scientists who'd worked during the 1970s and 1980s, contemporary with Dr. Keyes, she discovered that in those early days, many experts had tried to point out flaws with the cholesterol theory. But those who didn't join forces with the anti-saturated fat campaigners would be disinvited from committees, unable to get grants, and sometimes forced into early retirement. In 2015, a group of scientists who had reviewed the history of saturated fat research up to 1983, when the second official dietary guidelines for Americans was published, wrote an article disturbingly titled, "Evidence from Randomized Controlled Trials Did Not Support the Introduction of Dietary Fat Guidelines in 1977 and 1983. The scientists showed how, by citing the Seven Countries Study, the Dietary Guidelines Committee was able to position the cholesterol theory as if it had been clinically proven, but that was not actually true. To come to these contrarian conclusions, in some cases, all it took was checking the references. I did this myself when a cholesterol management guideline I was supposed to follow, called the ATP3, was released. Whenever the report made a claim that reducing cholesterol was beneficial, it cited a reference. So, I checked the references. I found the ATP3 repeatedly referring to scientific articles that kept the real data out of the publication, showing only data that had been adjusted by statisticians, making it impossible to validate the claims of the study. Another trick I noticed was shifting the goalposts. For example, the title and conclusions may claim that saturated fat causes heart attacks, but when you read the study, you see they actually found that saturated fat elevates cholesterol, and then refer to other studies supposedly linking high cholesterol to heart attacks. When you track down those studies, you find deception there too, such as missing data. Going from article to article, I started to feel like I was Charlie Brown, and the cholesterol theory of heart disease was Lucy, enticing me into kicking that football time and again, and time and again pulling the football away at the last minute, proving me the fool. Thanks to the body of nonsensical data the seven-country study contains, lowering cholesterol has since become a surrogate endpoint, standing in for preventing heart attacks. This means that if a study shows that a specific diet, such as one low in fat, lowers your cholesterol, then the authors can claim it will also prevent heart attacks. Likewise, it means that if a diet is known to elevate cholesterol, such as the Atkins diet, then the authors get to claim it will cause heart attacks. Dr. Keyes's thoughts still loom large on the nutrition research landscape. Dr. Keyes's force of personality, his bravado and bluster, may have prevented anyone from calling him out or calling his bluff. This enabled him to grossly misrepresent a very important data point at a pivotal time in the early 1960s. How many cases he had. A man on a mission. For all his flaws, Ansel Keyes does deserve credit for one idea. The idea that diet does matter. Dr. Keyes clearly believed that our propensity for disease is not entirely set in stone from the moment of our birth. He was operating from a belief that may have seemed to him like a minority viewpoint, the notion that we do have control over our fate, at least when it comes to heart disease. Perhaps it was knowing that to be true that drove him to such extremes. He also was among the first to point out that the U.S. Public Health Service's scope was too limited. The same notorious 1953 paper that misrepresented data had also challenged public health officials to look beyond infectious and occupational diseases. He called for a sweeping campaign to prevent or decrease the incidence of all forms of illness and disability, emphasis in original, particularly cardiovascular disease. For that, Dr. Keyes deserves credit. Of course, since the Public Health Service was a potential source of research funds for him, this was a somewhat self-serving announcement. Still, there were clearly some positives to his campaigning. But there is a potential moral pitfall you can end up in once you accept that dietary choices can cause illness. That is, to blame the victim. And Dr. Keyes was certainly guilty of that. A famous Time magazine article on Dr. Keyes quotes him saying, "Puritans in New England believe that obesity was a sin, and expressing this view that maybe if the idea got around again that obesity is immoral, the fat man would start to think." He lamented the weak will of people who chose indulgent fatty foods because they want to eat themselves to death. He also called obesity itself disgusting. Given this attitude, he may have blamed people for their own heart attacks long before he ever collected a shred of evidence. 4,820 missing cases. On January 13, 1961, Time magazine awarded Ansel Keys the title of Man of the Year. In the era before TV talk shows and the internet, a cover story in Time was the ultimate social proof. The article opens with the implication that the case against saturated fat was already closed. Americans eat too much fat. The calorie-heavy U.S. diet is 40% fat, and most of that is saturated fat, the insidious kind, says Dr. Keys, that increases blood cholesterol, damages arteries, and leads to coronary disease. It also paints Dr. Keys as decisive compared to other researchers who are bogged down with details. They variously blame hypertension, stress, smoking, and physical inactivity, while Keys gives these causes only minor roles. The article implies that Dr. Keys already had overwhelming evidence, reporting that in support of his idea, Keys's chief weapon has been the sheer weight of solid statistics. One man, identified only as a Philadelphia physician, is quoted saying, "Every time you question this man, Keys, he says, 'I've got 5,000 cases. How many do you have?'" Indeed, many people cite Dr. Keys's own claims more than they cite verifiable published data. Publication-wise, Dr. Keys had amassed an impressive 190 scientific papers under his belt. But most of his articles on heart disease were comments on work done by others, peppered with his own prosaic musings about the importance of doing more research. Only three of the investigations into the role of cholesterol in heart attacks represented his own original clinical work. It appears that by 1961, he'd evaluated the diet and cholesterol levels of just 180 heart attack cases, 72 of them from the Twin Cities, and 108 from Naples, Italy. By inflating this number, he successfully passed himself off as the singularly most knowledgeable person on the subject in the world. In 1961, the global effort to gather the data necessary to study the issue had only just begun. So by convincing the world he had so many cases, he gave the distinct impression that other scientists who might disagree with his cholesterol theory couldn't claim to have more expertise than him on the subject. In fact, he never did reach 5,000 cases. By the Seven Countries Study's final analysis in 1985, the total case count tallied just 2,289. So it appears that Dr. Keys shut down everyone who tried to question him with a fabricated number, and no one ever called his bluff. His ability to command authority must have intimidated scientists not accustomed to bullying. Perhaps most importantly, though, he'd curated close relationships with influential people, so that by the time he'd started throwing out grossly inflated claims, he was well protected by his friends in high places. The American Heart Association backs Dr. Keys, suppresses smoking data. Dr. Keys didn't work alone. He was aligned with a team of prominent physicians around the world, including Dr. Paul Dudley White, one of the founders of the American Heart Association, or AHA, and its former president, who was also President Dwight D. Eisenhower's personal physician, and Dr. Irvine Hindley Page, the acting president of the American Heart Association, and the first chair of research at the Cleveland Clinic. Harvard Medical had accepted Dr. Keys into their inner circle and endorsed his ideas, boosting their acceptance among physicians. Dr. Keys served as a key advisor and spokesperson for the AHA on issues related to diet, lifestyle, and heart disease prevention. The AHA also spent a great deal of effort and money educating the public about Dr. Keys's ideas. Together with Irvine Hindley Page and Jeremiah Stamler, a cardiology researcher then with the Chicago Board of Health, who would be credited with introducing the term risk factors into the field, In 1956, Dr. Keyes helped to launch the AHA's new prudent diet in a television campaign. The diet replaced butter, lard, beef, and eggs with vegetable oil, margarine, chicken, and cold cereal. With the weight of prominent physicians behind it, the arguments for the diet were persuasive, and it became popular. Millions abandoned traditional recipes in favor of a way of eating that looks like today's modern diet. Low fat, low cholesterol, full of processed foods, and saturated with vegetable oil. The AHA claims to be an evidence-based organization. But in 1956, when it launched its prudent diet, the first 7 countries study interim report was not yet published. It turns out that the AHA had received an infusion of cash from the vegetable oil industry, as we will see later in this chapter. This undisclosed conflict of interest gave it a financial incentive to promote vegetable oils as part of the prudent diet before there was data to back it up. The AHA also failed to disclose the increasingly convincing link between smoking and heart attacks. In 1956, the AHA issued its first statement on smoking and heart disease, saying, "Much greater knowledge is needed before conclusions can be drawn concerning possible relationships between tobacco smoking and increased death rates from coronary heart disease." In other words, there's not enough data for us to even consider issuing a warning about smoking. This was false. 2 years prior, the British Medical Journal had published a landmark study by the epidemiologist and medical doctor Richard Dahl that strongly linked smoking and heart disease. Dr. Dahl, who had been conducting research on the health effects of smoking for over a decade, had amassed about 230 heart attack cases among the nearly 5,000 people he'd been following. He had found a particularly strong correlation between smoking and heart disease, almost as strong as the association between smoking and lung cancer. Based largely on this data and related work, the British government took a stand against smoking in a 1957 report called Smoking and Health. The document offered physicians and health officials a one-stop, comprehensive review of the scientific evidence on the harmful effects of smoking, including its association with lung cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. It was the first publication of its kind to recommend that smokers consider quitting, or at least cutting back. However, during this time, the American Heart Association stayed laser-focused on Dr. Keyes and his talking points, funding research to attempt to prove the diet-heart hypothesis and ignoring everyone with different ideas. By 1961, the AHA had issued its first definitive dietary guidance to reduce intake of total fat, saturated fat, and cholesterol, and increase intake of polyunsaturated fat. Echoing the prudent diet, it advised swapping out butter, eggs, red meat, and cheese for margarine, cereal, chicken, and fat-free cottage cheese and skim milk. Supporting the rationale behind this recommendation was a 4-page report written by none other than Ansel Keyes, along with other members of the AHA. The report contains Dr. Keyes's opinions, but no supporting data. There is not a single footnote showing readers where to look for the evidence supporting this sweeping dietary recommendation. To be clear, when the AHA endorsed the cholesterol theory of heart disease, it had no data to support its validity. Instead of data, it offered innuendo. This suggests the strong possibility that when they funded Dr. Keyes's trips to 7 countries around the world, the results were a foregone conclusion, and that Dr. Keyes went through the motions for the sole purpose of making the endeavor look valid. That could explain why he didn't bother to create protocols for systematically collecting and presenting information. In addition to these irregularities, Dr. Keyes and the AHA also failed to warn the public that smoking might be an important factor driving heart attacks, going so far as to downplay the connection between smoking and heart disease, even though they certainly knew about it. According to a short book called The Seven Countries Study, A Scientific Adventure, by the first five-year analysis in 1963, Dr. Keyes knew that smoking 25 or more cigarettes daily increased heart attack fatalities by 400%, making smoking the most powerful predictor of death by heart attack by far. But he did not include this link between smoking and heart attacks in his 1963 publications, nor did he do so in the ensuing years. Dr. Keyes suppressed data from another study, too. Also in 1963, he reported on a separate project, a 15-year evaluation of heart disease risk factors among Minnesota business and professional men. His report makes no mention of smoking, but according to a film made about the project, he was paid to collect smoking data. It was one thing for Dr. Keyes to push his anti-saturated fat agenda, but for the entire AHA to downplay the smoking risk seems extraordinary. There was no obvious risk to the AHA for recommending against smoking. It seems not to have had any financial ties to the tobacco industry. Yet the AHA failed to issue any further statements on the harms of cigarette smoking until 1985, decades after the 1954 warning from the American Cancer Society and a 1964 U.S. Surgeon General's report that echoed the cancer connection, adding chronic bronchitis to the list of consequences. What would the AHA possibly have to gain by staying mum on cigarettes? To answer that question, let's take a moment to consider the cuckoo bird. This is the famous bird of Europe whose distinctive voice is imitated by cuckoo clocks. It's less well known for its peculiar parenting style, what's called brood parasitism. Female cuckoo birds lay their large eggs in the nests of smaller birds. The baby cuckoo hatches first, and within minutes, the blind, featherless newborn presses its back into the nearest egg, straightens its tiny legs, and heaves the egg up and over the edge of the nest. The baby bird repeats the process until there are no other eggs. The host mother then devotes all her time and food to rearing just the one baby, the cuckoo. The nest parasite strategy works for birds and for scientific theories. Cholesterol was Ansel Keyes's egg, and smoking was not. Dr. Keyes probably recognized that for his cholesterol theory to dominate the public discourse the way he desired, he would need to kill the other possible candidates for the cause of heart disease in the cradle, so to speak. The smoking gun that threatened the American Heart Association. The AHA wasn't the only organization dedicated to understanding the cause of heart disease. It had competition, and smoking posed a threat to the AHA's desire to dominate the conversation. Aside from the fact that smoking as a cause of heart attacks was a competing theory, there is something unique about this particular risk factor that made it more of a threat to Dr. Keyes's status as a global authority and to the AHA's status as the leading medical organization. It's a bit complex, but it takes us back to vegetable oil. Smoking doesn't elevate blood cholesterol, nor does it make people gain weight. It doesn't cause diabetes either. If smoking causes heart disease, it must work by a completely novel mechanism that had nothing to do with everything Ansel Keyes cared about. That mechanism is something we've talked about before in this book. Oxidation. Autopsies of heart attack victims dating back to the 1910s revealed oxidized cholesterol in arterial plaques. As far back as the 1920s, scientists recognized that injecting unoxidized cholesterol into the arteries of lab animals did not give them arterial plaques. Only oxidized cholesterol could generate arterial plaques. Dr. Keyes had a talent for biochemistry, so he could very well have recognized how this oxidation scenario threatened his idea. Cigarette smoke, by its very nature, could be presumed to exert toxicity through some kind of oxidative process, and by the 1950s, intense investigation into what elements in smoke caused this oxidation had already been underway for some time. If oxidation was the mechanism behind heart disease, too, this would present Dr. Keyes's ideas with a fatal mechanistic flaw. Remember, saturated fat is almost oxidation-proof. Polyunsaturated fatty acids, however, are extremely prone to oxidation, and once PUFA oxidation starts, it can spread until it oxidizes any nearby cholesterol. The oxidized cholesterol stays put in arterial plaques, making it look like a guilty party to anyone without the necessary biochemistry expertise, while the PUFA, having been oxidized, no longer exists. Given his background in biochemistry, Dr. Keyes would certainly have known all of this. If cigarettes could be linked to heart attacks, then so could oxidation. And researchers with biochemistry expertise would recognize that blaming saturated fat makes little mechanistic sense, and his theory could easily be disproven. His entire argument rested on correlational data, which, without a plausible mechanism, would be dismantled. And there was one more serious threat posed by the cigarette link: the correlation over time between per capita smoking rates and the rise of heart attacks. Cigarette smoking had been on the rise since the turn of the century, in almost exact parallel with the rise of deadly heart attacks. While he could have argued that correlation is not causation, his own arguments were entirely correlational. So if the world had been made aware of the very strong association between smoking and heart disease, that too could have snuffed the life out of his theory. Smoking and heart attack deaths would decline in tandem during the second half of the 20th century. The AHA has claimed that its anti-saturated fat campaign is partly responsible, but that too is unsupported. The amount of saturated fat Americans ate hovered at a fairly constant level throughout the entire 20th century. It didn't go up as heart attacks increased, and it didn't go down as they declined. We often hear the phrase, correlation is not causation. But without correlation, there can be no causation. And saturated fat intake simply does not correlate with heart attack deaths. The graph, labeled 6-1, found in the supplementary PDF, is based on readily available data. If the AHA was truly dedicated to preventing heart attacks, it could have shown this to the world 20 years ago. To understand why the AHA made the choices it made, we need to understand the impact and motivations of the organization as a whole. The AHA battles with itself over funding streams. Today, the American Heart Association has $1 billion a year budget, and thanks to heavy-hitting connections at places like Harvard Medical, its ideology powerfully influences the government's food policy, even though it's not a government agency, as its name might imply. The U.S. government document that encodes our official nutrition guidelines is called the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, or DGA. The committee of people who write the guidelines often includes members who currently or previously played important roles in the AHA. And because other institutions and organizations defer to the AHA for their nutrition ideas, the AHA and its nutrition ideology have more influence on the DGA than any other organization or group of individuals. The DGA, in turn, dictates what foods are made available in institutions and programs that receive government funding. For example, the taxpayer-funded Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, that serves an average of 41.5 million people per month. The DGA influences the menu served to the 33 million people admitted to hospitals each year, the 1.3 million nursing home residents, and the 2.1 million people in prisons around the United States. It also dictates what 41 million school children get served for breakfast, lunch, and snacks, as well as what colleges and universities can serve their 17 million students. Dietitians and physicians generally abide by these guidelines too, along with every other kind of licensed healthcare professional, from massage therapists to athletic trainers to dentists to nurses, and so on. The U.S. Department of Agriculture also abides by the DGA when deciding, for example, which crops get subsidized and which don't. These policies, in turn, determine what farmers grow and how much it costs, and therefore largely determine what's available on most grocery store shelves, most restaurant menus, and mostly everywhere else. All of this gives the AHA substantial, if indirect, influence over the foods many of us eat every day, even if we do not realize it. Who funds the AHA? The story of how the American Heart Association came to dominate nutrition thought begins with the very first industry to fund the AHA. As we'll learn, the AHA was effectively launched with a large sum of money that came straight from the vegetable oil industry. The AHA used this money to support Ansel Keys's cholesterol theory and to convince the public to start eating vegetable oils. The AHA continues to receive money from industries selling vegetable oil, and the AHA's practice guidelines continue to support the vegetable oil industry today. Today, our massive processed food industry depends heavily on vegetable oils, as do the companies that grow most of our foods. The AHA's top corporate donors now include heavy hitters from Big Ag and Big Food, including Conagra, Monsanto, before the company closed in 2018, Liberty Link, Kellogg's, Quaker, Tyson, Frito-Lay, Campbell, and Subway. The AHA's website states that 80% of their $1 billion-plus annual revenue comes from non-corporate sources. Nevertheless, in 2021, drug and device companies donated just over $40 million, and other corporations donated more than $140 million. The AHA uses this money in part to support scientists interested in exploring the benefits of vegetable oils, the harms of cholesterol, and new ways to use drugs that lower cholesterol, and to publish and publicize their findings. The money also goes to lobbyists who influence public health policy at the state and national levels. The AHA also publishes, or co-publishes, 14 medical journals on various subjects related to cardiovascular disease treatment, research, and practice standards. The total volume amounts to thousands of articles per year. This makes it easy for the organization to keep the anti-cholesterol message top of mind. Notably, other medical and scientific publication outlets have printed dozens of articles that have called the diet-heart theory to question. The AHA, however, appears to have published none. Funding research through donated money is a cornerstone of the organization and a mechanism for controlling what doctors learn. The AHA has donated $5 billion to research since 1949. $461.7 million during the 2021-2022 fiscal year. As a result, it has tremendous influence on health and nutrition research. It gets to decide which topics will be investigated and which studies will be published in its journals and which studies won't, which in some cases means they won't be published at all. Because of its long history, wide-ranging influence, and extensive publications, the AHA has become the organization that other organizations turn to for guidance on nutrition. This includes other nonprofits, such as the American Diabetes Association and the American Cancer Society, as well as medical organizations, like the American Medical Association and the American College of Physicians. The fact that other organizations unquestioningly accept the AHA's ideology hinders basic, necessary nutrition and toxicology research. During my interview with Dr. Eric Decker, a food scientist I introduced in Chapter 1, he pointed out that nutrition leadership is hung up on cholesterol, while it should be focusing on oxidation. My biggest frustration with all these nutrition groups is they don't know how food is made or how food changes during processing, he said. According to Dr. Decker, even experts at the National Institutes of Health don't understand the relevant oxidation science. He explained that whenever he has submitted grant proposals to the NIH to test the health effects of oxidized oil, the grants would get killed. The criticism of his applications was always the same. These compounds, the toxins he and others have detected, aren't there in concentrations enough that they're a problem to human health. Since the NIH's decision makers don't believe the toxins are present in meaningful amounts, they don't believe it's worth pursuing the research. So Dr. Decker and a tiny handful of toxicologists know about the toxins, but doctors and other scientists do not. That makes it hard for the food industry to keep the food supply safe. It also makes it hard for toxicologists to do their research. According to Dr. Frances Sladek, whom we met in Chapter 3, her biggest challenge is the perception that vegetable oils are the healthy fats, and saturated fats are unhealthy. Because of that perception, she told me during an interview, the people who need to approve her grants believe the science is already settled. She told me that this perception, more than the financial aspect, is the reason why she's met huge resistance and has to fight an uphill battle trying to get this stuff funded and published. It makes her work all the more valuable, and in my mind, it makes anyone daring to pursue the truth a scientific hero. So, here we are today, where we have toxicologists and experts in food safety who disagree with the AHA's position on the safety of polyunsaturated fats. And because the AHA's vast influence gives it control over nutrition thought, these professionals have trouble getting necessary work funded. Meanwhile, the AHA continues to actively promote seed oils, and it continues to support those like Dr. Walter Willett, who dismiss or discredit experts like Dr. Chris Ramsden, who are producing evidence to the contrary. In other words, the AHA is effectively blocking progress in medical science, and perhaps most egregiously, it is promoting a diet that's actively harming our cardiovascular health. In the beginning, however, the association's culture was very different. When the AHA was founded in 1924, it was supported only with annual dues from a small collection of doctors concerned about the growing problem of heart disease. Heart attacks skyrocketed after World War I, and the organization felt the pressure of knowing there was so much to learn, but such little funding to do the necessary research. In 1942, AHA Executive Director H.M. Jack Marvin, a New Haven, Connecticut cardiologist, made an ambitious proposal to solve the AHA's chronic fiscal problems. Lack of funds stood in the way of two of the organization's highest priority goals, sponsoring research and establishing public health and lay education programs. Without fundraising, the organization would be limited to utilizing the small pool of government funds to achieve its goals, and that pool had just grown a little too crowded for the AHA's tastes. In 1946, a newly founded organization calling itself the American College of Cardiologists, or ACC, threatened the AHA's access to the limited supply of funds. Collaboration with this new organization might have been another option, but apparently that was not on the table. By 1946, the AHA had grown large enough that it was divided into two camps with polar opposite visions. One group, the expansionists saw a need to embark upon a broad expansion of activities and to employ a firm of specialists to outline a fundraising campaign. The other, the contractionists, wanted to keep the emphasis upon the small, strictly scientific, professional, and clinical aspects of the association, and didn't see a need to solicit outside funding. That year, several members of the expansionist group wrote a letter to the AHA's president, calling for a dramatic restructuring of the organization. They lamented the many other organizations espousing the cause of heart disease. The existence of these other organizations threatened their concept of the AHA as the dominant organization in the cardiovascular field in the country. Aside from exaggerating the number of organizations, there was just the one, the ACC. The letter raises questions about the group's values. It makes no mention of actually improving public health. Among the contributors to this letter were several men who would later serve leadership roles in the newly restricted organization. They spoke openly about eliminating competition. According to internal documents, AHA leaders hoped to suppress the new organization and attempted to discourage physicians from joining the ACC. Achieving sole authority status seems to have been at least as important as doing the necessary research to provide useful information to the public. By 1948, the expansionists within the AHA had failed to suppress the other organization, but they had accomplished a coalition within their ranks. After all the saber-rattling, the reformers were galvanized into action. That year, the expansionists put their proposition to start soliciting money from the public and industry to a vote. Let's consider who might have been in a position to make the largest donations. The obvious answer? Giant multinational companies. AHA members who objected to the proposal argued somewhat prophetically that the organization might be tempted to make unjustified claims about the cure of heart disease. After intense debates about the pros and cons of opening themselves up to conflicts of interest that might impede scientific progress, a narrow majority voted in favor of reframing the organization's financial structure from member-based to donation-based in order to broaden its scope. A journalist, Nina Teichholz, has painstakingly examined the AHA's meeting minutes from that time period to unravel its early industry entanglements. For a 2014 book, she wrote, "For decades, the American Heart Association was small and underfunded, with virtually no income. Then, in 1948, it got lucky." In 1948, the AHA received a cash infusion of $1,740,000 from a fundraising campaign tied to a popular radio contest called Walking Man. The company sponsoring the contest was Procter & Gamble, the world's largest manufacturer of cottonseed and other edible oil products. The AHA had just partnered up with vegetable oil. The impact on the AHA's ideology was immediate. Before 1948, the AHA president, and one of the most ambitious reformers, Dr. Paul Dudley White, didn't believe saturated fat caused heart disease. According to his colleagues, he was initially critical of Dr. Keyes. After 1948, he followed the money, joined with Keyes, and changed his tune. He would become the first president of the new AHA. Those against the reform would have been watching their worst fears being realized, and in fact, several of them abandoned the AHA for its competition. Because, as history shows, the new AHA immediately started making unjustified claims about the cure of heart disease. And it has continued doing so ever since. A deal with the devil. The AHA had gotten lucky. But it wasn't dumb luck. It was the brilliance of the man at the helm of the PR firm P&G had retained, Edward Bernays. Bernays is widely recognized as the de facto inventor of the public relations industry, and he's probably the 20th century's most influential person that most of us learn nothing about. He wielded influence behind the closed doors of the most powerful corporations and political leaders in the world, including at least four presidents, several multinational companies, and the Central Intelligence Agency. He'd begun in advertising, where he revolutionized the industry. Before Bernays, many advertisers tended to tout the practical, rational aspects of their products, things like durability and effectiveness. Bernays taught advertisers to manipulate people's emotions instead. He'd learned about the power of emotions from an uncle he'd grown up admiring, none other than the father of modern psychiatry, Sigmund Freud. Bernays took Freud's theories about the inner workings of the individual mind and applied them to groups of individuals so that those in power, his corporate and government clients, could better control the population. Bernays wondered, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing it? For Bernays, gifted with mind control skills befitting an Orwellian villain, the answer was clearly yes. It may be impossible to overstate the degree to which Ed Bernays influenced the culture of the 20th century, for better or worse. In the late 1920s, he'd had a hand in ad campaigns for the American Tobacco Company, calling cigarettes torches of freedom. This equated smoking to an act of emancipation, thus elevating women who smoked from their status as trashy while also giving them a sense of power. The Virginia Slims advertisements of the 1970s built its brand concept on Bernays' initial image of female smokers as modern, liberated women. If your tap water is fluoridated, as it is for nearly three-quarters of the U.S. population, that's thanks to Bernays. In the 1940s and 1950s, he worked on behalf of the U.S. Public Health Service to convince the American public that water fluoridation was safe and beneficial to human health. The industry needed some good PR to clean up its image because of where fluoride comes from. One of the most common forms of fluoride added to our water here in the United States is fluorosilicic acid, which is derived from the scrubbing systems of the phosphate fertilizer industry. In other words, chimney soot from industrial plants. Of course, strict regulations ensure it gets cleaned up and rendered safe for consumption. His influence was not limited to the United States. In the early and mid-20th century, Bernays's work on behalf of the United Fruit Company impacted a vast swath of the political landscape across Central and South America. Bernays used many tools from his kit of public relations techniques to promote the interests of United Fruit. He worked with the CIA and other agencies to create a propaganda campaign portraying the democratically elected president of Guatemala as a communist and a threat to U.S. interests, which ultimately led to his removal from power. This had a chilling effect on democracy and social justice movements in those countries, as governments were more likely to be overthrown if they pursued policies that were seen as threatening to U.S. business interests. Bernays not only knew how to manipulate people, he knew how to get people excited about being manipulated, a process he describes in detail in his 1947 book, The Engineering of Consent. The book enumerates a variety of persuasive techniques, including propaganda, advertising, and other forms of mass communication that he used to create seemingly any desired response from the public. While today we might think differently, he didn't see any problem with using psychology for these purposes, and in fact believed his work was essential and beneficial. He felt it was important for educated elites to control the people he considered uneducated. It was good for commerce, capitalism, and the democratic process itself. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses, he had written in an earlier book, is an important element in democratic society. In other words, he and his clients know better about what's good for us than we do. One of Bernays's favorite manipulative techniques involved tapping into the immense psychological power of medical doctors. Doctors were a key instrument for Bernays to choreograph behavior, because a doctor is an authority to most people, regardless of how much he, the doctor, knows or doesn't know. Citing his 1993 interview with Bernays, who was 102 at the time, journalist Christopher Bryson wrote in a book about fluoride, "You can get practically any idea accepted," Bernays told me, chuckling. "If doctors are in favor, the public is willing to accept it." One of Bernays's favorite tactics for promoting new ideas and products to the public was to stress a claimed public health benefit. He described its effectiveness as child's play. By catching Bernays's attention, the AHA hit the jackpot. Thanks to Bernays, the AHA's many budgetary concerns evaporated overnight. Certainly, companies had paid individual doctors to endorse products before, but this was a whole other category of relationship. The AHA represented an entire specialty of medical doctors with ambitions to lead the conversation on heart disease. The money would be used for everything the AHA had hoped to accomplish. It was enough to fund both cardiovascular research and nutrition education programs for the public. Dr. Keyes and the AHA had unknowingly become the benefactors of more than money. They'd been handed the golden ticket, a proven and winning formula with a track record of phenomenal success. In one fell swoop, Bernays helped take the AHA from its unimportance, as he described it during the 1993 interview, and made it a large, effective organization. The $1.74 million that the association received because Bernays selected its name from the pile of possible contest beneficiaries rocketed the newly reformed AHA off to a stellar start, converting it from a collection of egotistical cardiologists into a national powerhouse. This infusion of money, worth about $30 million in today's dollars, provided the AHA with the funds it needed to become the dominant force in cardiovascular research, just as the ambitious expansionists had envisioned. More than just a professional society with a research and education arm, the AHA had joined the ranks of true influencers, or as Bernays described it, those who manipulate the unseen mechanism of society and constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. The ideas that Ansel Keys and the AHA were promoting about saturated fats were especially valuable to Procter & Gamble, because at that time, the edible oil industry had a serious marketing problem. Remember, consumers had resisted these oils since their introduction in the early 1900s. That resistance had no doubt frustrated the entire edible oil industry, particularly as oil production ramped up in the early post-war period. Bernays couldn't have done better for P&G than to pick the AHA from among the heap of other nonprofit organizations the company might have donated to. Since the AHA was already saying that saturated fat was unhealthy, it might even agree to say that vegetable oil, which contained virtually no saturated fat, was healthy. Of course, Bernays may not have known about Ansel Keys, but he was probably confident the investment would pay for itself, since, by the law of averages, you can usually find an individual in any field who will be willing to accept new ideas, and the new ideas then infiltrate the others who haven't accepted it. In other words, knowing how the world works, Bernays gambled that some doctor would figure out how to take advantage of the money in ways that would benefit the company. And the gamble paid off handsomely. As history shows, the AHA was not only willing, but it opened the floodgates. Remember the Prudent Diet? The AHA's 1956 program promoting vegetable oil? It specifically cited saturated fat as the cause of heart attacks and promoted vegetable oil, virtually free of saturated fat, as the antidote to heart attacks. Coming from the nation's top doctors, the new dietary recommendations made a powerful, if unfounded, argument compelling the growing numbers of housewives gravely concerned about their husbands' health to give up their traditional ingredients for good. It also offered a more actionable step than convincing their spouses to stop smoking. Suddenly, the old, inexplicable prejudice against the use of vegetable oil vanished. P&G, one of the leading producers of vegetable oils, reaped the rewards as its products started flying off the shelves. The Prudent Diet eventually became a book that sold millions of copies, went into multiple reprints, and is still in use today. Unlike the other organizations Bernays had helped, the AHA didn't actually hire him. And so the AHA's decision makers and scientists may never have had any direct conversations with the puppet master who'd pulled their strings. As far as they knew, the money the AHA received from Procter & Gamble was a lucky break, and it was a no-strings-attached scenario. Except that it wasn't, if they wanted more. And no doubt, Ed Bernays, who continued to work for Procter & Gamble for many more years, knew what the future would hold. His client, P&G, would continue to benefit from the relationship, and the AHA would continue to come back to the industry till. There was no reason not to. After all, if Dr. Keyes was right and their product was healthy, then why not develop a closer relationship? The AHA made friends of many companies selling vegetable oil who would later make hefty payments directly to the AHA for the use of its heart-healthy checkmark emblem. Their course was now fixed. The people at the AHA would continue to work within the oil is better than traditional fats paradigm to serve their own ambitions and the needs of their newfound friends in the vegetable oil industry. Some within the AHA must have felt it was a deal with the devil, but it probably seemed like a dream come true to a man like Ansel Keyes on his mission to prove his detractors wrong. Unfortunately, for everyone alive today, whenever Dr. Keyes failed to substantiate his theory, he was unable to admit he was wrong. As we saw in Chapter 5, he even chose to suppress his own data rather than publish the results of the failed, to him, Minnesota coronary experiment. Ansel Keyes passed away in 2004 at the age of 100. The AHA founders have long since retired, having successfully captained the AHA to the position of dominance they'd aspired to. There's no one left to suffer the embarrassments of having been wrong. True leadership might be best defined by willingness to recognize mistakes and change directions when necessary. But the AHA is staying the course. So this flawed theory would seem to be kept alive for financial reasons only. As we will see in the next chapter, the fear of cholesterol is now a key mechanism powering the vast economic engine of the American medical system, a system that grows stronger, larger, and more profitable the more we depend upon it. Whether you're healthy or not, the failed diet heart hypothesis is costing you money, and chances are it has cost people you know their lives.